gentlemen, welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station. Here's Terrible Tommy here in the bunker. Yeah, this is a Tuesday, Tears Day, and it's 11:06 here in the Midwest, Eastern Standard Time, and it's the 17th of May, 2016, here in the bunker. Don't forget, we're at P.O. Box 401. How could you? 401, area code 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show, and if you don't have them in for this month, you better get them in. I think almost everybody's got their donation in for the show, but if you go much longer, you're going to be temporarily taken off the roll. That's right. I don't like to be cruel. Oh, well, sometimes, yeah. And sometimes it's fun. I see that conservative group, Breitbart, the false flag right wing. Well, it is. No, it's not false flag. It is right wing. That's what right wing is now. It's not racial at all, and they tell you they're totally against racial. Just a few years ago, they would have been a little bit racial, but not anymore. They declare, we despise racism and separatism and anything like that and white supremacy, and we just want to can't we all just get along? Well, that Breitbart outfit's over at the Con Film Festival today. That's going on big time. Hundreds and hundreds of movies over there trying to get recognition that we're the best movie going. Breitbart's got the Clinton Cash, and that's fine, exposing the Clinton Cash, but what about the Republican Cash? what about those boys? They didn't make a movie about that. And also they got that duck call man down there promoting his super Christian nonsense. And they do get a lot of people coming up to him and say, well, we don't go along with the religion stuff, but we sort of like the movie. So he is sort of an interesting guy with that big long beard. I guess he's trying to emulate Abraham or somebody like that in the Bible. One of these guys that never existed, but people like to copy him. Well, I want to get my film in there, too, pretty soon, and the title is Tax the Churches, you know, since the churches get tax-free in this country, and that's why everybody wants to be a preacher. Yeah, you want to make some money, I see around, we got one place here in town, it's an old gas station, and somebody's put a sign up there, this is the Holy Roller Brotherhood of the Brother Bell or something, and they're taking in money because you can make a tiny living off a little church like a lot of these Mexicans do, or you can make a lot of money off the big church, yeah, tax free, and then you can afford to send a lot of it out of the country to Jamaica or some pest hole somewhere in the world instead of taking that money and helping people in your community. Helping people in your community, well, maybe a little bit, but not so much as to deprive me from my Cadillac limousine and my golf course membership. Yeah. Well, boys and girls, it's time to go back to school again, and we're going to go back to this book I started on yesterday, The War Myth in the United States History. And the reason I'm doing this is because to relate why these wars we've been in, especially up until the Second World War, were not needed. They could have been avoided. And, of course, the Second World War could have been avoided. All these wars could have been avoided. And the reason I'm talking to you about this, because of all the white people, the Aryans, who die in these wars, and most of the time it had nothing to do with the benefiting the white race or the Aryan race. And that's our problem. The conservatives, or the right wing, and even the right wing of the racial idea, unfortunately, tend to gravitate towards war. And we're going to kick their ass, you know, that type of thing. You've heard it. I remember back in the Cold War days, it was, we're going to kick the Russians' ass. We're going to nuke those fuckers, you know. And, of course, that doesn't bode well for the white race or the Aryan race. So we've had millions of people die. Look, 55 million people died in World War II, at least, and a good share of them, a good percentage of them, were white. And maybe you didn't know it, but the same thing for World War I. And, of course, World War I was the stepping stone and the basis for World War II. If you don't like Hitler, well, they shouldn't have had a World War I, because World War I guaranteed there'd be somebody. His name might have been Alphonse or Jones or something like that, but somebody had to get Germany out of the mess. So that's why I'm reading this, because there's hardly any anti-war activity that I can see in the racial right. So we have to forget about the racial right when it comes to anti-war activity and borrow some of the positions of the liberals or the left. And if you don't like that, that's too bad, because that's just the way the cookie crumbles. There's quite a number, a lot of anti-war organizations, and I don't have a lot of money to support them, but if I did, I would support them, because anti-war will save more white people than any war ever did. In fact, I can't think of any war we've ever been in that really saved very many white people. In fact, just the opposite. It killed them, you know. So here we go back to the war myth in the United States history, and we're going to go into the, let's see what we're going into today. Now, this is a war that not too many people think about, because it wasn't the Revolution, and it wasn't World War I. It was called the War of 1812. There were two different causes of the war with Great Britain in 1812, and it's necessary to examine each separately. These causes were maritime rights and land hunger, so didn't have anything to do directly with race. The general European upheaval from 1879 to 1815, known as the French Revolution, soon developed into a war between Great Britain and Napoleon. Again, not to save white people, but for land and so forth. All Europe was divided into two camps, with Great Britain and Napoleon as leaders on their respective sides. Almost a decade before 1812, Great Britain began issuing decrees known as the Orders in Council. These orders in council, issued in the name of the king, attempted to prohibit neutral nations from shipping goods to France. In this manner, a blockade was proclaimed against France, and the ships attempting to get through the lines were subject to capture and confiscation. Napoleon issued similar decrees known as the Berlin and Milan decrees, declaring that any ships en route to Great Britain would be subject to capture, for France had also blockaded Great Britain. But as neither blockade could be fully enforced, they were both to a large degree disregarded. Now, did anything here have anything to do with race and the survival and the advancement of the white race? I don't see it. Both Great Britain and Napoleon were attempting to cut off each other's trade and not primarily trying to disregard the rights of neutrals. All goods attempting to run these blockades were subject to capture. The principal losers through these captures were the New Englander traders. And, of course, they were in it for profit, right? But they preferred losing occasional ships to joining in a war which would involve them with their principal customer, Great Britain. There had been no serious crisis since 1807, 5 years before war was declared. Napoleon was then losing fast, and it seemed evident that it would be only a short while before the causes of friction would be over. The flagrant disregard of the rights of the neutral trade had taken place before 1807. In 1812, the solution, or the end of the problem, was in sight. In 1810, our registered tonnage in foreign trade was 981,019 tons, which high mark it was not to reach again until 1847. Our foreign trade was not ruined, and the New England merchants who sustained the loss wanted nothing done. They were Federalists and would have preferred a war with France rather than a war with England, because they regarded Napoleon as the real cause of all the trouble, which is never true, boys and girls. The Federalists were pro-British, while the Democrat Republicans were pro-French. Early in 1811, our minister, William Pinckney, left London, and thus the United States was cut off from a knowledge of the movements in England. England was attempting to avoid war with America because such a war would naturally hurt her foreign trade and domestic prosperity. In other words, it was common sense, which rarely exists. By the spring of 1812, England was ready to revoke the orders in council as soon as it could be done with dignity, but this fact was unknown to America. We didn't have telephones back then and cell phones. On June 23, 1812, the orders were revoked, but this was 5 days after the War of 1812 had been declared. England did not know war was declared when the orders were revoked, and the United States did not know until a good while later in the season that the orders had been revoked. Perhaps modern cable communications would have prevented this war and the loss of a lot of white lives. Another source of friction lay in the impressment of seamen and sailors. During this period, Great Britain was hard-pressed for men in her naval campaign against Napoleon. Many sailors deserted English ships and came to America because of the higher wages paid by the owners of American ships. Every British warship anchored in American waters would lose a good part of its crew who would secure positions on American ships. Great Britain demanded the return of these deserters who would often become naturalized citizens in the colonies. Great Britain, however, at that time regarded citizenship as a contract between the citizens and the government, which could not be broken without the consent of both. Well, of course, the government don't have to consent to anything. Disqualifying the sailor from citizenship in the United States without her consent. This European custom has now disappeared, of course, and one can change citizenship at will. But you can't change your race, boys and girls. You can't change your race. When the United States refused to return these men, the British ships would search American vessels on the high seas to see if any British soldiers or sailors were on board. This policy of impressment waned, however, after 1805 because Napoleon had been defeated on the sea and Great Britain was not in such a great need of sailors. Impressment was not made a cause of the war until after the war had begun and President Madison had learned that the orders in council had been revoked. President Madison, that shouldn't go to war so easy and so quick. Let it simmer a while, or don't go at all. President Madison in 1812 estimated the number of impressments at 6,057, but the Massachusetts legislature appointed a committee to investigate the situation, which reported that the Madison estimate was 3 or 4 times too large. Great Britain took the position that the United States was acting as a harbor for her deserters from the British Navy. The merchant ships, that therefore the search was warranted as a defensive measure. The British orders in council prohibiting the trade of neutral powers with France and the British impressment of fugitive sailors from English ships were the maritime controversies which resulted in the War of 1812. But basically, it was greed and money, and not much foresight to the best interests of the Aryan race at all. Both policies on the part of Great Britain were adopted as necessary measures in her conflict with Napoleon. New England Federalists were the people principally concerned in the United States, but they opposed the war, and they want their cake and eat it too. They want their profits, but they don't want the war either. War was declared by a vote of 79-49 in the House and 19-13 in the Senate. There was open discouragement of enlistment in New England. The governors of Massachusetts and Connecticut refused to honor President Madison's call for the militia. Henry Adams estimated that the New England bankers loaned more money to Great Britain than to the United States for war purposes. Isn't that the way it goes? There's no loyalty among thieves. Of the 17 million in specie in the country in 1812, about 10 million was in the hands of the New England Federalists. They subscribed less than $3 million to the United States war loan. In other words, actually, they were traitors. Thus, strangely enough, the war of the war of 1812 was fought in spite of the protest of those for whom it presumably fought. But in recent years, another cause of the war, and the chief cause, has been discovered. This was land hunger. Greed, speculators. The United States entered the conflict at the insistence of the South and the West, despite the opposition of the northeastern states. The inland section overruled the opposition of the maritime section. At that time, there was an ardent expansionist sentiment along the whole western and southern borders. Looking toward the annexation of Canada and Florida. And these are speculators, big time land speculators, and in the guise of being politicians in most cases, with a vaguer idea of seizing all of Spanish possessions in North America. Spain then owned Florida. Spain and Great Britain were allies against Napoleon, and a war with one was looked upon as a war with both. The belief that the United States would someday annex Canada had existed continuously since the Revolution. Why? Betterment of the race? I think not. Greed? I think so. Benjamin Franklin had advocated the buying of Canada by the United States since we failed to take it during the Revolution. Well, why not just leave Canada alone to develop on its own? The Continental Congress made an effort to capture Canada, but our armies were repulsed, and many white men died. Washington had objected to leaving Canada in British hands. In 1803, Governor Morris of Pennsylvania wrote that at the time of the Constitutional Convention, he knew that all North America must at length be annexed to us. Who is us? Happy indeed if the lust of dominion stopped there. This idea, however, was a vague dream till about 1810. There had been friction in the Northwest between the Americans and the British. The British retrained trading posts in the Northwest after they had agreed to give them up by the Treaty of 1783, recognizing the independence of the United States. But who pays any attention to treaties? In fact, once treaty law was put into our Constitution, the Constitution was dead as a doornail. These were held to compensate the Tories for their property confiscated during the Revolutionary War, which had not been done. For this reason, the British held the Northwest Post until 1796, when they were given up by the Jay Treaty. Here's another treaty. All the Mongol trouble in that section was attributed to the British propaganda, which incited the Mongols against the United States or against the white population. The Canadian traders made friends with the Mongols to get their trade while the Americans were aggressively pushing them back from their land. The result was that the Mongol was more friendly to the British in Canada than to the United States. You see how that affects the race? So the Canadians and Mongols were out there sometimes killing white people of the United States and vice versa. You know, yeah, we had two or three of those, more than two or three of those wars, the French and Indian Wars and so forth, where both England and France recruited the Mongols to fight and kill white people. Doesn't sound very racist to me. The idea of annexing Canada was intensified after 1810 because of the belief that the Mongols were being turned against the United States by the British. The South was almost unanimous in its demand for the annexation of Florida, stealing it from the Spanish, while the Southwest was taking a lively interest in Mexico. This land hunger was making its appearance rapidly, but it was several years later that the phrase manifest destiny was to come into general use, and that was a bad idea. Manifest destiny was, you know, it was a white man's destiny to take over all these non-white lands. And the problem is, well, he took them over all right, but then he race mixed with them and imported them into his white country and all that kind of stuff. So it was a definite problem for the white race, a big problem. It still is. President Madison and Secretary of State James Monroe were eager to annex Florida. Thomas Jefferson was interested in the annexation of Canada, Florida, and Cuba. Well, you see, the average person wouldn't be into that, but only big shot leaders and politicians and land speculators are in it for that, and that causes a lot of war, a lot of killing. Jefferson considered the acquisition of Canada only a question of marching, with Florida and Cuba easy prey from Spain. These expansionists were in favor of declaring war, while the rest of the country opposed the idea. But you see, the expansionists usually win because it's based on greed. They use a lot of fancy nationalist terms to cover up the greed, but basically that's what it is. When Congress met in 1811, Henry Clay was elected Speaker of the House. He was leader of the war group known as War Hawks, and we still have them all over the place today. There's one guy who was in the, I forget if he was in Clinton government or something, or in the UN, and he's a big war hawk. I see him on TV all the time. Damn, I can't remember his name. That son of a bitch, that's all he thinks about is war, war, war. Of course, he's in company of a lot of other people who believe the same thing. He was the leader of the war group known as the War Hawks, Clay was. Here's a guy, you know, these guys, these politicians, if you ran into them on the street and threatened to punch them in the nose, they'd run their ass off the other way. Basically, most of these political people who want to take over everybody else's land, they're cowards themselves, personal cowards. Yeah. The first Speaker of the House of Representatives to recognize the great power he could exercise over legislation through his appointment of committees, you see. So these politicians and greedy bastards create committees of other cowards, and then they get together and write up a paper and take somebody's land. That's basically it. Not very Aryan as far as I'm concerned. I don't think our Aryan forefathers were that Aryan in their heart. I think they were warmongers and people who wanted to occupy other people's lands and steal their stuff. He was the first czar of the House. On the Foreign Relations Committee, Clay appointed Peter B. Porter, chairman, Calhoun of South Carolina, Grundy of Tennessee, Harper of New Hampshire, and Desha of Kentucky. The things that these men put in move, they started things off, and all the things they did, you don't remember their names anymore at all. I mean, Clay, of course, you probably remember. All these guys do these things that get ourselves screwed up, the white race in trouble, and then they die and it's it. But their laws and regulations go on and on and on. All these were ardent expansionists and reliable war people, war hawks. They represented the frontier section of 1812. And Clay had been chosen speaker by the representatives from that section. In December 1812, while on the Foreign Relations Committee, Porter said in discussing trouble with Great Britain, we could deprive her of her extensive provinces lying along our border to the north. Grundy and Rhee, ardent expansionists from Tennessee, agreed. Well, let's rip off England. R.M. Johnson of Kentucky, during the same session, made the statement, I shall never die consented until I see her. Great Britain's expulsion from North America and her territories incorporated within the United States. And Harper of New Hampshire said in Congress, to me, sir, it appears that the author of nature has marked our limits in the south by the Gulf of Mexico and in the north by the regions of eternal frost. These statements were representative of the sentiments of the members in Congress from the western section. The Federalist Party consisted chiefly of mercantile and financial interests of the coast towns. They were solidly against expansion, which would give the economic advantage to the western section of the country. The winter of 1811-1812 saw a great expansionist wave swept over the west, clamoring for the annexation of Canada. Let's take it over. Commentary newspapers were filled with the editorials demanding annexation. The cry came up from the whole frontier, New Hampshire to Kentucky, to expel the British from Canada. At a Washington's birthday dinner given at Lexington, Kentucky on February 22, 1812, the toast proposed was Canada and our arms, although the frontier claimed that the British were inciting the Mongols against the United States, or, in other words, white people. L.M. Hacker in Western Land, Hunger, and the War of 1812, that's the title of his book, proves that the Mongol menace was greatly exaggerated, but that land hunger was the real motive. There you go. Real estate men, speculators, been one of the big problems for our race. Randolph of Virginia, who was opposed to the war, said in 1812 on the floor of Congress, ever since the report of the Committee on Foreign Relations came into the House, we have heard but one word like the whippoorwill, with but one eternal monotonous tune, Canada, 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 take Canada. The South and the Southwest were interested in the annexation of Florida and possibly Texas. To them, a war with Great Britain meant a war with Spain also, since the British and the Spain were then in alliance. So you see all this stuff? Nobody wants this. The bulk of the people want to live in peace. They really do. But they're always being inflamed by these. They were the capitalists of the day, the predatory capitalists of the day. They want the land. They don't care how they get it. If they have to have war to get it, they'll have war. President Madison and Secretary of State Monroe, in their eagerness to acquire Florida, had helped a General George Matthews to instigate a revolution in Florida. In 1812, General Matthews took American troops to Florida with the cooperation of the War Department and also support of Governor Mitchell of Georgia. This territory was held for a year, although Congress twice refused to authorize the president to hold it. Finally, Madison was forced to repudiate the act because of the opposition to the Federalists and the northern members of his own party. Senator Crawford of Georgia was active in his support of southern expansion. I wonder if he ever tried to go across the street or go down the road and take over his neighbor's property. Probably did. No, he wouldn't. He'd call in the army to do it, because these guys basically are gutless. Politicians are basically fucking gutless. Jefferson wished to annex Cuba as a state, and Madison and the Monroe were eager to annex Florida, although they were not concerned with the appropriation of Canada. I begin to think most of these founding fathers were not getting enough sex. These guys didn't, they weren't getting enough sex. They're always wanting to take over something. The interest of Southwest in Mexico was a spirited one. McCaleb, in his book on the Aaron Burr conspiracy, points out that Burr simply attempted to do in 1806 what the whole Southwest was dreaming of. He was conspiring against Spain and Mexico, and not against the United States as it usually supposed. Lands, waterways, and Indians was the cry of men desiring to drive out Spain. In the Nashville Clarion of April 28, 1812, there appeared a long article advocating the annexation of all America, closing with a statement, "Why is it written in the Book of Fate that the American Republic shall not stretch her limits from the capes of the Chesapeake to the Nootka Sound, from the Isthmus of Panama to the Hudson Bay?" Yeah, take it all! The paper then editorially commended the article to its readers and followed it up with a series of historical and descriptive articles about Mexico. Of course, I believe this country would have been, I think it would have been in much better shape if it would at least just kept the states and maybe even left some foreign people like Spain and England to have kept some of the land here in the United States. I think we'd be in far better shape. The War of 1812 continued for 2 years. Troops were raised to invade Canada, but interest in the venture was slight. Many of the militia refused to march out of American territory, as it was understood then that militia could not be ordered to foreign soil. Well, that was good. The expansionists could have united to declare war, but plans of expansion collapsed. Yeah, and did they have the money to support the war? That's the question, too. These guys, it's easy to declare war, but how are you going to pay for it? Oh, I know. Rob the little people. The northern states opposed the annexation of Florida without Canada. Do you think the masses of people in the states and the colonies were for this kind of stuff? They were, especially when they found out what it was like to get a musket ball in their head if they go out in the army. The troops could never take Canada. Madison and Monroe were interested in Florida, not Canada. The British repulsed the troops from Canada. The South had no desire to acquire northern territory because they were sectionalists, and that was good. The War of 1812, in fact, was a complete failure from every angle. Our troops were defeated. General Winfield Scott declared that the army officers were generally sunk in their either sloth, ignorance, or habits of intemperate drinking. Swaggerers, dependents, decaying gentlemen, utterly unfit for any military purpose whatever. Muzzy in the United States of America through the Civil War book, Volume 1, page 253, says the War of 1812 was a blunder. Well, I think the Revolutionary War was probably a blunder, too. It was unnecessary, impolitic, untimely, and rash. It was primarily the work of Henry Clay. If the United States had been in any condition to fight, we should have been of great aid to Napoleon, who at that time was being defeated by Great Britain. In the Peace Treaty of 1814, which brought the war to a close, the causes of the war were not mentioned. They don't like to do that. Well, don't make any difference. Korea, Vietnam, none of the... Oh, what was the war all about? I don't want to talk about it. The War of 1812 was a war of paradoxes. It was waged ostensibly in defense of maritime commercial interests. But the merchant states themselves threatened to secede so as to stop it. The English orders in council, the alleged cause of the war, were repealed 5 days before the war was declared and before news of the declaration reached England. The most important battle of the war, the Battle of New Orleans, was fought after the Treaty of Peace had been signed. So all those guys that died at the Battle of New Orleans were screwed. The United States did not get any of the desired territory. was defeated in nearly every campaign, and the capital was burned by the British. The land was not gained, and the rights on the sea were not granted. England never yielded the right of impressment, which remained a diplomatic controversy as late as 1842. In order to save its reputation, the administration published an exposition of causes and character of the war prepared by A.J. Dallas, in which it was denied that the administration had ever tried to acquire Canada. Madison was a great scholar, but not a strong executive, and it was the War Hawks led by Clay who forced the war upon him and the nation. Well, how many men died in that war of 1812? And even the capital was burned down and the whole bit. So what did the white race gain there? What did they gain? What do they ever gain when they go to war? Some white rat politicians get what they want. The bankers, including Jews, get what they want. But it's always a disaster for the average guy. Now, tomorrow we're going to go into the war with Mexico, another loser war. And there was a tremendous amount of opposition to that war, too. It almost broke up the country. Polk was the president at the time. I think his first name was Henry. Speaking of squabbles with Britain, here we go again with Trump saying his thing, and then the leader over there in Britain going off half-cocked. And I don't know what you think about this getting out of the EU, which I think is great. A few years ago when it started, I thought it'd be a good thing, like what Uncle Adolf was trying to do. But I see it turned out badly. It's very bad. They need to get out of it. But anyhow, so here is Donald Trump coming back at them.
I don't care. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's fine.
But you're president and he's the British Prime Minister.
It looks like we're not going to have a very good relationship. Who knows? I hope to have a good relationship with him. But it sounds like he's not willing either.
Would you like, David
when
Cameron,
it was brought up,
would you like him to withdraw the particular comments that you're stupid, divisive, and wrong with your view about Muslims?
Well, number one, I'm not stupid, okay? I can tell you that. Just the opposite. Number two, in terms of divisive, I don't think I'm a divisive person. I'm a unifier. Unlike our president now, I'm a unifier.
You know, these politicians, audio might have been a little weak, but these politicians, they build themselves by attacking other people. And what's his name there in England is trying to bolster his bullshit position and by attacking Donald Trump. And Trump comes back and he gains votes by attacking the premier over there in England. It's a game. It's a scam. It's a typical cowardly political way of doing things. I think we should go back to the dueling. Meet the guy on the in the meadow with the guns. Dueling would eliminate a lot of politicians, both physically and office-wise. Boy, this Liberty College with Falwell starting to gain a lot of political interest. Here we got 2014, Mormon Glenn Beck spoke there. In early 2015, Senator Cruz decided to announce his bid for the Republican presidential nomination at Liberty College. You remember Falwell? What a clown. In November 2015, Dr. Ben Carson addressed the students during one of their mandatory convocations. Carson is not the brightest bulb. I think he's got a mental problem. And not just because he's black either. 1 month later, University President Jerry Falwell Jr. made the national headlines by encouraging students to carry guns so we could end those Muslims if they were attacked. the college offers a concealed weapons certification course for students. You know, I figure they're probably, the Muslims are getting ready to attack Liberty College. You know. Let's see here. In January 2016, President Hopeful Donald Trump delivered a speech to Liberty students during which he made his famous 2 Corinthians blunder. The same month, Falwell Jr. endorsed Trump's candidacy for president, comparing him to Jesus and his late father. Wow. Let me see here. I got to bring this up here a little bit. I'm here. Okay. All right, let's see here. I'm losing my place here. Well, that's about it. These decisions elevated Liberty's status as a leader, if not a kingmaker, with conservative populism. They're two different things. A movement whose ideology is marked by anti-elitism and distrust of government institutions, including the Republican Party power brokers. The establishment. Beck is a popular leader among populists. All of a sudden, they're starting to use the word populist. And Cruz, Carson, and Trump each positioning themselves as political outsiders. Liberty's commencement seems to push the school further in the populist direction. They don't like that word conservative anymore, I guess. Rashad Jennings, a nigger, remarked, "Whoop, I'm sorry, he's a black guy. He's an untouchable." Remarked that he wasn't politically correct enough to be president. He added, "When it comes to political issues, there's one thing that literally trumps everything and helps everything go back into normal, proper perspective, and that is that of the Bible tells us we can overcome this world by our faith." Well, you'll never overcome this world. You might as well forget that, boy. Robertson, the Duck Dynasty star, whose son is a student at Liberty University, addressed the crowd with his homespun southern accent while wearing an American flag bandana. Quote, "Be infectious around people with a positive attitude of Christ," said Robertson. The Robertson family's conservative social and political views have created much public controversy in recent years. Mel Gibson is a similar controversial figure due to a DUI arrest, verbally abusing comments towards women and screaming about the kikes. But his blockbuster film, The Passion of Christ, has made him a revered figure among some Christians. Well, anyhow, that's enough of that crap. Let's find something else to talk about here. I see the Jews are putting out a new Bible called the Messianic Prophecy Bible, and they're giving them to Christians. And so that just shows you how I've said all along, of course, that the Bible is pretty much just a Jewish thing. I mean, there's some other things in there, but it's primarily Jewish. And so when these people deny they're teaching Judaism in their churches, they're lying through their teeth, and they're teaching their little kiddies Judaism. Also calling this Bible the Hebrew Bible for Christians. And you can reserve your free Bible today if you go to one of these Israeli outfits on the internet. That's all you need is a Hebrew Bible for Christian. Well, here's an interesting little article. I can't believe it. Apropos of Steve Saylor's recounting of New York's Hug Thug, a black man who offered free hugs to women in Times Square and sometimes punched them if they didn't tip him. I have a question. Why hasn't the man or men in some woman's family stopped this violent pervert? I've been asking this for decades. Where are the families, boyfriends, and so forth, when things like this happen? The woman he assaulted with a can of water and iced coffee claims she has a boyfriend. Even if that isn't true, where were her father or brothers or male friends? Why hasn't a single man of this woman's acquaintance put this dangerous weirdo in the hospital? Why hasn't a man or men on the scene intervened? Jermaine Himmelstein has been arrested 12 times since 2012 for similar crimes. I've been asking the same question for years about O.J. Simpson. Why didn't one man in Nicole Brown's life stop him the very first time he beat her to a pulp? No one stopped him, and she wound up dead. The answer to my question is this: feminists and anti-racists have emasculated the American white man. No shit. He fears defending his women in general, and he fears defending them against black predators in particular. Well, then he's no good and worthless. I suspect that most of the Hug Thug's victims are white, partly because he fears being called a racist. That would be much worse than being called a coward. This may have been what paralyzed the three white men who did not fight the black Carr brothers when they perpetrated the Wichita Massacre. Maybe they were just scared, but one can't help but think that those three good whites and two good white women believed that fighting the Carrs would have been racist. Who cares if it's going to save your life? To prove one isn't racist, he must lay down his own life? Hug Thug can be stopped. Question is, who's going to do that? Well, too bad I'm clear over here in Indiana. There's got to be some New York people who can talk to that guy out on Times Square. Well, a gay pastor apologizes after accusing Whole Foods of writing a slur, racial slur, on the chocolate cake. The case of the chocolate cake slur, it seems, was simply a hoax. An openly gay Texas minister who had accused Whole Foods of defacing his cake with an anti-gay slur dropped his lawsuit against the grocery chain on Monday, issuing an apology and said he was wrong to perpetuate this story. He also apologized to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community for diverting attention from real issues. You got a picture of it here. The cake says, "Love wins, fag." Whole Foods had forcefully rejected the accusations of Mr. Brown, 31, and he is very brown. He's a untouchable, who claimed that he had bought a frosted cake from the store in Austin, Texas, and asked that the words "Love Wins" be written in icing on the top, only to discover while driving away that a slur had been added. Mr. Brown's apology represented a remarkable about-face from his remarks last month, delivered at a news conference alongside his lawyer, during which he choked back tears as he told the story. "For me, it was humiliating," he said then, "because being a pastor who is also openly gay, I've had to deal with this in the past, and literally the feeling that I had just resurfaced a bunch of painful memories of things that have happened to me," unquote. But a day after Mr. Brown's legal salvo, Whole Foods denounced the pastor as a fraud, vowing to press a countersuit that sought $100,000. At the same time, the grocery chain released surveillance footage of Mr. Brown's purchase that it said proved that the cake had not been tampered with. Whole Foods said in a statement Monday that it would drop its lawsuit. They shouldn't drop it. Afraid of being called racist? "We're very pleased that the truth has come to light," it said. "Given Mr. Brown's apology and public admission that his story was a complete fabrication, we see no reason to move forward with our countersuit to defend the integrity of our brand and team members." Now imagine Imagine if that had been a white racist that had done something like that. Do you think they'd drop the suit? Hell no. The case of the anti-homosexual cake slur had captivated the Texas Capitol, where Whole Foods is based, as thousands of people debated the evidence on social media and in the comment threads of the Austin American-Statesman. Austin is a very anti-white racial town. It's been that way for a long time. My television show used to be on in Austin. Is there any existing criminal behavior under which hate hoaxes could be prosecuted? If not, should there be a law against hate scams? Well, of course. Clearly, our culture is vulnerable to hate fraud by people looking for money, fame, and or to spread hatred of disfavored groups such as straights. Straight white men. Let's go back in history a little bit on this one. This is from L.A. Quiet. This is from L.A. This guy says, I've mentioned many times that in my experience growing up in Los Angeles, San Fernando Valley in the 60s and 70s, white flight from public schools was pretty much Jewish flight to avoid integration due to the 1978 mandatory school busing imposed by an ACLU lawsuit on the giant Los Angeles school district. Why? Well, back then, Catholics tended to go to Catholic schools, and Protestants living in independent school districts like Pasadena, San Marino, and Orange County. Moreover, San Fernando Valley Jews were highly enthusiastic about public schooling. One of my older memories is hearing from my Jewish teammates on my baseball team at the local park that Catholic schools were kind of un-American. Jews went to public schools to demonstrate their commitment to civic Americanism. Wow. But then, very quickly, they stopped. Yet that massive historical example that happened 38 years ago at the heart of the world capital of entertainment industry has largely been lost in the mist of time. Thus, when 27-year-old Atlantic interns denounced all those horrible white people who white-flighted away from integrated schools, they tend to picture evil white Southerners who were probably secret Klansmen, meat-headed Catholic ethnics, and snobby WASPs who wouldn't let Nana's father into their anti-Semitic country club, but not people like them. So I figured I'd better post a rare 21st century article documenting that I'm not just hallucinating at this history from the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles 7 years ago. Brief History of Jews in the Public Schools by Rachel Heller. With the many LAUSD schools having spotty reputations and given the array of private schools to choose from, Jewish support of Los Angeles public schools in recent years has been at best tepid, but that wasn't always the case. Jews in LA have been a long and textured relationship with the public education system. From the 1890s, when the city's first established elementary and high school districts, through to the 60s, public education was a mainstay of the Jewish community. But when school demographics began to shift as working-class Latino, mestizo, and untouchable American populations burgeoned, many Jewish families pulled out of public schools and migrated to the private realm. The Jewish exodus from LAUSD reached its peak during the desegregation movement of the 70s. After the ACLU filed a lawsuit in 1963 to end segregation in LA schools, the LAUSD board created voluntary integration programs introducing magnet schools and giving district schools the option of busing students from lower performing facilities to higher performing schools. In 1976, the California Supreme Court charged state school districts with enforcing integration. In response, 2 years later, the L.A. School Board began a sweeping mandatory busing program that would reassign more than 60,000 students, transferring minority children from downtown and South L.A. to predominantly white schools in the San Fernando Valley and the West Side, and vice versa. Wasn't that a wonderful experiment? Is racism gone because of it? This was a particularly nuts example of the high tide of liberal social engineering, since it involved busing kids from San Fernando Valley over a mountain range, the Santa Monica Mountains and Hollywood Hills, and down to South Central L.A. Students often were bused up to an hour away from where they lived, and the move caused a public outcry among both whites and minorities over what many parents saw as the end of neighborhood schools. According to former LAUSD school board member David Tokoski, racist and classist prejudice also turned some white families away. In the first year of forced busing, the district lost 25,000 white students, recalling Shell Ehrlich, the former longtime head of the LAUSD communications office. In the second year, an additional 17,000 whites left. In 1981, after only 3 years, California residents voted down all mandatory busing programs, and the plan in Los Angeles was suspended. But the damage had been done. In the late 70s, Ehrlich said the district was about 30% white. Now that number hovers below 9%. Busing drove a huge number of Jews from the public schools, said local author and Jewish Journal columnist Bill Boyoski. Parents were not comfortable sending their children to a school where their kid might be the only white person in the class. Jewish leaders had taken both sides of the busing debate. Educator Jackie Goldberg, who would later win seats in the Los Angeles City Council and the California State Assembly, headed the controversial integration project in the late 70s that pushed for mandatory busing. Activist and later U.S. Congresswoman Bobby Fiedler, on the other hand, led the vocal bus stop movement in the Valley that fiercely opposed busing and challenging the program in court. I remember those days quite well because part of that time I lived in the L.A. area. Private schools flourished. Jewish day schools proliferated in the 70s and 80s. So I wanted to get this on the record because it's otherwise disappeared down the memory hole. Thus, when the young lady from the Atlantic speaks of Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men, going on and on in interviews about how he could tell there were anti-Semites lurking everywhere in 81 at the ultra-exclusive Harvard-Westlake in the Hollywood Hills, which was then 40% Jewish, she feels a righteous thrill. Meanwhile, it never occurs to her to wonder why Weiner's parents were paying for him to attend an exclusive school founded by Episcopalians, when just a few years before they would have thought it right and fitting to utilize Los Angeles' fine public education. The young lady from the Atlantic could empathize more with the creator of Mad Men more than she can empathize with the Klansmen, Catholic ignoramuses, and the WASP anti-Semite golfers, for whom she blames the failure of school integration, but she's almost never called upon to wonder why Weiner's Hancock Park parents put him in private school. It just doesn't come up. Why would anybody who is professionally interested in the history of white flight from the public schools ever think about something as obscure as America's second largest school district, which happens to be in the second most televised place in America? By the way, one of the funnier interviews with Weiner was conducted by David Samuels, who is now being widely denounced by members of the Obama administration media echo chamber for inducing Obama speechwriter Ben Rhodes to spill his guts a little too frankly about the administration's good. But Samuels does not does this to everybody, especially fellow Jews. He's super smart about getting inside a subject's head and getting him to speak about his motivations that he normally keeps under wraps. And that's the end of that. Let the pan call the kettle black, huh? Well, now that we know Jews are involved in every dirty, rotten thing going on in the world, just like other people are, well, that's it. And that's it for today. And I'll be back tomorrow, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. In the meantime, 14:05.
We live. We fight. And we die. For each other. Not for you.